Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, Kat. Welcome back.
Well, hi, Lantern. I missed you. I've been away a while.
I know. You've been over the great sea.
Yes, on having adventures. Having adventures. So, and I hear we have wonderful guests and storytellers on tonight. So this will be wonderful.
Welcome.
Oh.
There's an echo in here.
I will. We'll have to see. Probably there's something there. Okay.
There we go.
There it was. It was me. I apologize.
Oh, that's quite all right. Quite all right. You brought back double the fun.
Yes. So why don't we get started since we have a few storytellers? I would like to, since we're coming up on Halloween, I thought it would be a great time to tell some stories about All Hallows Eve, and I have a little story I wrote years ago about it. So if you will, I'll start talking about it.
Well, please do, Kat, please do.
Okay. So All Hallows Eve is Samhain, the Celtic festival that marks the beginning of winter. And Samhain means summer's ending, and it's the time when the sun's power wanes and the forces of winter and darkness, and therefore the gods of the underworld grow in strength. So it's a celebration of the dead when the veils between the worlds open and the spirits of the dead can come into our world. During this time, in ancient times, all the fires were extinguished and the new fires could only be rekindled from a sacred fire that the druids would light. And Herm the hunter and his white hounds would sweep through the skies as they hunted the souls of the dead and of the dark. So in English-speaking countries, of course, we celebrate All Hallows Eve or Halloween. And Halloween is the time when sprites and trolls and nature spirits, as well as spirits of the dead, can commune with human beings. These spirits, they always demand some form of nourishment to propitiate them because all spirits, both good and evil, crave life. Everything craves life, even death. So, hence, this is our custom of trick-or-treat. And in Latin countries, the memory of this festival was celebrated by the Catholic Church as the Feast of All Saints on November 1st and the Feast of All Souls on November 2nd. And the southern countries, the Latin countries, celebrate this. Usually, the Day of the Dead, they offer not only prayers, but families leave food in the cemetery a lot. In Mexico, they all go to the cemetery and they bring food to their ancestors. So anyway, on Samhain, we're reminded that we too are children of the Earth Mother and that we have to face death. And we have to acknowledge that death is the other face of life. And in facing death, the death of another year, because in the Celtic calendar, this is the end of the year and the new year, as well as the possibility of our own deaths, we acknowledge the rhythm of life is slowing down. Because now the darkness is going to grow, and the life force turns within. It retreats into the underworld until the nadir is reached on the winter solstice, when the light of the world is reborn once again. So I always think that the gift that Samhain brings us is the knowledge that in accepting death, the possibility of change in new life is just around the corner. And so this is a Samhain tale. The cold silvery light of the full moon reflected off the bone-white bodies of his hunting dogs as they raced the winds through the clouds. With a smile cold enough to match the moonlight, he raised his arm above his head and sent out his call to the winds, and they silently began to gather around him. blood-red eyes shone with a hypnotic intensity as his hounds raised their heads to him, eagerly awaiting his command. The moonlight reflecting off the top of the cloud banks was blinding, and all he could see of his pack were gleaming red coals of fire flaming out of that field of white. He waited as the winds gathered their fury, now moaning and shrieking in the airy heights. And a column of air funneled high into the atmosphere above his arm, straining to be let loose on the world below. Finally, with a cold, triumphant shout, he finally flung his arm out. And with an explosion of sound and movement, Hearn's hunt was on. Now the old woman huddled more deeply into her cloak as the winds tugged at it with angry fingers. The coldness stung her eyes and then froze the tears as they formed. The wind shook the trees above her until the last remaining leaves flew free to brush against her on their wild ride to the forest floor. Ha! It will take more than a strong wind to scare me on this black night, the old woman thought with a grin. Wiping her eyes and pulling the hood of her cloak closer around her head, she looked up. Through the now bare branches, she watched as the moon sailed in and out of swiftly moving clouds, and then looked down at the forest floor that shifted in shadows with the comings and goings of the moon's light. Slowly, she continued on her way through the dark forest. Before she emerged into the hidden meadow, the woman stood within the shadow of the trees to stare out at the dark mound rising into the sky on the far end of the field. With cries and groans, shrieks and howls, the wind swept through the treetops in a wild, dark dance. In the sudden, wide expanse of sky, she could see how the clouds formed dark masses whose tops became snow-white fields as the light of the hidden moon shone down upon those moving clouds. Ah, sweet lady of the night, the woman felt her heart swell with love as the moon suddenly shone out into the clear, cold night, turning everything to enchantment. The old woman released her breath as the dark veiling was drawn once again over the lady's bright face, but that momentary vision had given the old woman new sight. Looking at the whitening fields above her, she saw ruby eyes and blood-red ears as Hearn's hunting hounds rampaged through the night sky. And she heard Hearn's cold laughter sound in her ears, and she thought, so it begins. Now another woman walked through the forest on her way to that secret mound. As the moon revealed herself to the old woman, her light found its way to the forest floor, as this other woman stepped onto an old bridge crossing a stream. An ancient being watched her stop to look up at the sky and saw that the woman was of middle years, with a strong face bleached white by the moonlight. As this woman watched the cloudy veil, he thought, I'm hidden away from the human woman's sight. It wouldn't do for her to see me on this night of nights. And with a chuckle, he hunched down into the shadows beneath the bridge and faded into the boulders that held up its wooden beams. Now that woman standing on the bridge threw back the hood of her cloak as she looked up into the face of her mistress, the moon. Ah, the goddess plays with us tonight. And the woman smiled in pure delight as the winds tossed leaves back and forth over the stream, sending them in twirling dances high into the sky, to left to gently spin down as they were forgotten and left behind. As the clouds raced by, creating shadows only to spear them again with light, the woman caught sight of a gnarled figure scampering away under the bridge, and her breath caught in surprise to see an ancient one on this night of all nights. Her mistress was indeed with her tonight. Keeping her eyes on the tumbled boulders, the woman stepped off the bridge and climbed down to the rocky stream bed. Leaning down into the darkness beneath the bridge, she looked directly at a large gray boulder and said, "Good evening, old troll. Will you come with me to the fairy mound?" And with a grumble and a groan, the old one threw off the illusion, his illusion, and tumbled out of his rocky nest. What else can I do on this night of nights with the moon sight on you? And pulling up her hood to hide her smile, the woman reached down a hand to help the troll up. Now a third woman hurried through the night. She lifted her cloak as she leapt over a fallen tree trunk that lay in her path. She ran through the shadows and she ran through the silvery light, afraid that she was late. It seemed like she was always late and always hurrying, like those clouds sweeping through the sky overhead. But there's so many things to see, she thought, so many interesting places to explore. She slowed down to watch the flowing moonlight dance in and out among the tree trunks. This young woman stopped, entranced, as a dark shadow flew through a moonbeam. And then when the moon threw off her veils and flooded the forest with light, there off to the girl's left sat a white owl, staring at her out of the lowest branches of an oak tree. When the light suddenly vanished again, the young woman stepped off the path and found her way to the tree. It was an ancient tree, a grandmother tree, and the wind barely moved its upper branches. The young woman went and put her face up to the rough bark and, breathing softly, sent out tendrils of awareness into its core. And in the silence of her own heart, the woman felt how the tree absorbed the wind's violence, taking it in and transforming it into vibrations as it carried its messages down into the earth. The woman heard it as it moved through the tree. Herne the hunter was riding with his hounds. The wild hunt was abroad in the night. As soon as the young woman came out of her silence, the wind shrieked around her head and flew off in the direction of the fairy mound. Looking up into the shadows, the woman found the white owl staring down at her. And as she stepped away from the tree, the owl silently took wing and settled heavily onto her shoulder. The young woman looked into wild, fierce yellow eyes for a moment before the owl lifted away and flew before her into the night. Hurrying down to the path, she swiftly followed the ghostly shadow as it flew to the hidden meadow at the center of the forest. And so the three women finally came to stand at the very edge of the forest meadow, one at the north, one at the south, and one at the east. On the western end of the meadow rose up the mound, darkly brooding beneath the moving skies. The women silently watched as the winds gathered in a whirlwind above the dark mound, where mighty Herne sat on his own dark steed, as the old crone saw clearly enough. Then Herne's arm pointed to the north, and the winds were suddenly banged with the voices of many hounds. The girl of heaven looked down upon her child, the living earth, whom she nourished and sustained with her light and governed with her rhythms. One rhythm had been struck that night, a rhythm of power and terror, the rhythm of death. The night of the dead was upon the earth, and the moon mother offered her light to help strengthen her child's children as they met their fate, as the earth herself walked through the veil to meet death. The three women came forward and stood before the mound. With hands uplifted, they prayed in the silence of their hearts. Their prayers were offered to their mothers for the strength and courage to meet their task, to look upon the face of death and live. While the woman prayed in the bright moonlight breath of the mother, the mound before them drank in that light, and it started to move. The earth on the hillside rippled and shuddered and exploded in little volcanoes of dirt. Then, as if two giant hands slowly ripped apart a woven veil, the mound split open. A dim light outlined the breach for a moment, but it was suddenly blocked by a dark figure stepping up to the opening. For a moment, the women felt the warm, fragrant winds of springtime and smelled the intoxicating scents of lilacs as they one last cloud swept over the face of the moon. The cold and the women huddled deeper into their cloaks. When they looked back at the mound, they saw that the woman was now veiled in black. Silently, the four women waited while the moon poured down her light and blessings upon them. Slowly, a vast silence sucked away the last breath of sound in the meadow, and the veil between the worlds opened further upon the night. The dark figure of the earth in front of the mound slowly turned away from the three women and walked through the torn veil, walked into the land of the dead. In the place where she had disappeared, there now shimmered above the mound a presence of terror and splendor, dark wings outstretched into the starry sky above. And the crone quickly stepped forward and, raising her arms, began to chant an ancient song, a song of power to hold the angel of death at the door which had opened between the worlds. The second woman turned to the troll, who had been watching in terror and delight the opening of the veil. And so, calling to the other sprites, gnomes, and trolls rollicking on the far end of the meadow, he hurried forward to stand next to the woman who had called to him from beneath his bridge. Now he was compelled to do her bidding as the others were compelled to do his. And with much tumbling and tossing, shrieking laughter, the spirits of the earth took a stand in Fern Vale. And in the lightness, and with the lightness of a laughing heart, the woman turned to confront the demons who were trying to force their way out of the rift. The demons took on all the faces of fear, trying to get by that line of imps. But just as terror began to overwhelm the woman, a troll would tumble forward with a loud and smelly bellow, and the demon would dissolve in the mist. Or a sprite would imitate the fierce and deadly faces before them, and soon they were rocking with laughter at her antics. The demons, unable to produce one tremble of true fear, shrunk and shriveled up and ran shrieking back to hell. And still the old woman kept up her song, and the angel of death stood guard before that dark door. The third woman, the youngest, the maiden, also set about her task. Looking into the eyes of the owl once again sitting on her shoulder, her vision followed after the wild hunt as it gathered in the souls of the dead. There was one she especially looked for, one who was the other half of her own soul. When it was time, it was with joy and sorrow that she finally caught sight of him flying before the hounds. He was always quick, and even death has not taken that away, she thought. The tear that rolled down her cheek fell to the ground unnoticed. And so she called to him who led the dead on their last journey. Called, he came to where his heart still lived. Called, he led the souls a merry dance before the hunting hounds. Called by love, the other souls remembered and so flew before the winds to that dark door. Baying and belling, the white hounds ran upon the wind, their master riding behind, driving the souls towards that broken veil. Hearn's horn resounded through the cold night air as they came to rest high above the secret meadow once again. The bone-white bodies leapt and danced beneath the prancing feet of Hearn's dark mount, while the souls descended to the earth like a lowering mist. The owl flew off to settle on an oak branch as the young woman turned to face that misty gathering of souls. The terror of the dead was settling over the forest, and yet she stood forth to meet them unafraid. For there before them all stood her beloved. With love and sorrow, she looked upon his far and distant love, for there was no warmth left in him. And as they stood there, the living and the dead, something happened. A little imp, one who had clung to his mother as they
Well, hopefully we haven't lost Kat completely. We'll give her another minute to show up. Lil, are you there?
I am indeed. I thought that there was something going on with my connection.
No, that's Kat's connection.
Okay.
Oh, there you are.
I'm still here.
We lost you for a bit there, Kat. Your connection's fading in and out.
Okay. Well, anyway, so when the ghost finally turned towards the veil, the host of dead souls moved through the night with him. The three women saw their sifted lives in full, saw faces full of great sorrows and of great strength. The three stood and witnessed the ghosts of young and old float silently through the waiting veil, while the dark angel of death held open the gate. When the last of the dead had disappeared through the veils, a great light shone from within the rift, as if the souls themselves had turned to light. And then with a mighty shaking of wings sank back into the rift. The three women, deserted now by all the imps and sprites except for the old troll, watched as the veil began to reweave itself in the gray morning light. The moon looked down upon her children with a final blessing before vanishing beneath the horizon. The jack-o'-lanterns the imps had fashioned to frighten away the demons were scattered around the mound. Then just before the veil was once more
Hello, Kat. Well, I think we're going to have to go on.
Okay. So anyway, I'm back, I think. And so one more second. And
okay,
so
sure.
It was with quiet laughter that the women took up the jack-o'-lanterns with the new light to carry home. The light would light their hearths, and the others in the village would come to them, and the fire of the souls of the dead would live on to bring warmth and light to those they left behind. And the old troll took up his light and departed for his hill above the stream. And Herne the hunter looked out across the fields of heaven and called his hounds home as the sun rose over the winter sky.
Very good.
And that is the story of Samhain.
Interesting. Thank you, Kat. Welcome back. Lil, why don't you go ahead and take it away?
Okay, I will do that. I'm going to kind of pick up a little bit where she left off. Interestingly enough, the proposition that Halloween is in any way related to Satanism is a completely misguided thought. The concept of Satan as Christian would have had no meaning for the Celts prior to Christendom taking over their land. And that's when Halloween became a mixed observance with the imagery and tradition of the pagan festivals now incorporating Christian constructs like the devil and angels and demons and lost souls. In modern Irish, Gaelic, and Old Irish even, with a slightly varying pronunciations, the holiday is actually the name for the month of November, and also a reference for the first day of November and a harvest festival making the end of summer. And there are a number of bodies of Irish folk heroes, as well as sagas of traditional heroes, that contain many references to Samhain. Many of the adventures of these heroes and many of their campaigns were undertaken by the characters beginning on the Samhain Night Feast. One of those is the boyhood deeds of Finn, centering on the exploits of Finn the Cool and his warriors, the Fianna. Now, the tales of Finn, which are a mixture of humor, romance, magic, and love, and wild nature, fell mostly in the region of Cormac MacArt, an historical figure who lived in the 3rd century AD. Legend would have it that Finn was his great captain. During his reign, the Fianna of Erin, composed mainly of members of two clans, Clan Daskna and Clan Morna, were devoted to the service of the High King and to the repelling of foreign invaders. During this period, they reached their height. For fear that Clan Morna, who had slain her husband, would find him out and slay her son, Then another gave him to be nurtured in the woodwood by two aged women, and she herself became wife to the king of Kerry. But Dimna, when he grew to be a lad, was called Finn, or the fair one, on account of the whiteness of his skin and his golden hair, and by the name he was always known thereafter. His first deed was to slay Leah, who had the treasure bag of the Fianna, which he'd taken from Finn's father. He then sought his uncle, who, with a few other men, survivors of the chiefs of Clan Basna, had escaped the sword at Castlenook and were living in much affliction in the recesses of the forest of Connaught. These he furnished with a retinue of guards from among a body of youths who followed his fortunes and gave them the treasure bag. He himself went to learn the accomplishments of poetry and science from an ancient sage and druid named Finnegas, who dwelt on the Liverbourne. Here in a pool of this river, under the bough of hazel from which dropped the nuts of knowledge of the stream, lived Fintan, the salmon of knowledge, which whosoever ate of him would enjoy all the wisdom of the ages. Finnegas had sought many a time to catch the salmon, but failed until Finn had become his pupil. Then one day he caught it, and he gave it to Finn to cook, bidding him eat none of it himself, but to tell him when it was ready. When the lad brought the salmon, Finnegas saw that his countenance had changed. "Hast thou eaten the salmon?" he asked. "Nay," says Finn. "But when I turned in on the spit, my thumb was burnt, and I put it to my mouth." "Take the salmon of knowledge and eat it," then said Finnegas, "for in thee the prophecy has come true. And now go hence, for I can teach thee no more." After that, Finn became as wise as he was strong and bold, and it is said that whenever he wished to divine what would befall, or whatever was happening at a distance, he had to but put his thumb in his mouth and bite it, and the knowledge he wished for would be his. Now Finn went to Tara, the great assembly, where no man might raise his hand against any other in the precincts of Tara. He sat down among the king's warriors and the Fianna. At last the king marked him as a stranger among them and bade him declare his name and lineage. "I am Finn, son of Cool," he said, "and I am come to take service with thee, O king, as did my father." The king accepted him gladly, and Finn swore loyal service to him. No long time after that came the period of a year when Tara was troubled by a goblin or demon that came at nightfall and blew fireballs against the royal sky, setting it in flames, and none could do battle with him, for as he came, he played on a harp of music so sweet that each man who heard it was lapped in dreams and forgot all else on earth for the sake of listening to that music. When this was told to Finn, he went to the king and said, "Shall I, if I may slay the goblin, have my father's place as captain with the Fianna?" "Yea, surely," said the king, and he bound himself by this oath. And there was among the men-at-arms an old follower of Finn's father, Cumhal, who possessed a magic spear with a head of bronze and rivets of Arabian gold. The head was kept laced up in a lantern case, and it had the prophecy that when the naked blade was laid against the forehead of a man, it would fill him with strength and battle fury that would make him invincible in every combat. This spear, the man Fiacon gave to Finn and taught him how to use it, and with it he awaited the coming of the goblin on the ramparts of Tara. As night fell and mist began to gather in the wide plain around the hill, he saw a shadowy form coming swiftly toward him and heard the notes of the magic harp, but laying the spear to his brow, he shook off the spell, and the phantom fled before him to the fairy mound. That's where Finn overtook him and slew him and bore back his head to Tara. Then Cormac the king set Finn before the Fianna and bade them all either swear obedience to Finn as captain or seek service elsewhere. And first of all, Gol Magmorna swore service, and then all the rest followed, and Finn became captain of the Fianna of Erin, and ruled them until he died. He ruled them as no other captain ever did, both strongly and wisely, and ever bore a grudge against any, but freely forgave a man all offenses save disloyalty to his king.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Now that's just a bit of the story. There's much more that when you get a chance, you let me know and I will be happy to tell you more.
Well, we're going to take you up on that.
Right.
Good, good. Well, I've got a tale tonight that's a true story from my adventures in spirit space. I've been investigating mental powers, spiritual energy for a very long time. And I was invited by one of my meditation students to come to see a medium. Now, a medium is someone who is alleged to be possessed by entities. No one knows these entities. No one knows where they are. And I had never actually seen anything like that, so I wanted to be prepared. So I looked up the ancient volumes to see what ancient sorcerers, what ancient magicians, what ancient mystics said you should prepare before you meet a medium. Since the wizards and mystics of old had a series of studies, academic research that they had done on spirits, they had a set of guidelines on how one should behave when one approached this. So I read the studies, so I was prepared. I came to a place on Miami Beach where these adventures were going to take place. I was introduced to an old man, bent, ragged. And I was told that he was possessed by an ancient Egyptian princess named Princess Tara. Now, I was very skeptical. I assumed that the old man had psychological problems, that I thought that the simplest explanation was the best explanation. Well, I was then told that this Princess Tara comes to this man on a regular basis. And I asked if I could proceed to investigate a little and ask a few questions about the way this happened. And I was told by the woman that toured this man around, there was a woman in charge of this old man, and she said, sure, I could ask any question I wanted. Well, the first question I asked was ones that the ancients had warned me about. They said, the first question you always must ask a medium is, do they control when this spirit comes? When I asked, I was told that no. This spirit came in its own good time, came when it wanted, left when it wanted. The old man had no control. That was a bad sign. Then the next question I asked was, when the spirit leaves, does the old man feel strong? Does he feel charged up? And the ancient said that if he did feel good, if he felt energized, if he felt livened, that was a good sign. That meant it was a good spirit. But if, on the other hand, he felt drained, he felt exhausted, and literally was just wasted away of energy, that was a bad sign. That meant that that spirit, that entity, was taking energy from him rather than giving him the benefits of high spiritual energy. And then the last question was, does this spirit, when it speaks through this old man, does it speak truthful things, accurate things, or does it make broad pronouncements? Does it just scare people? And I was told that the spirit usually spoke in generalities and often frightened people that it talked to. Now, those were not good signs. But I was determined, as a Taoist, to not take any fear or favor from it, but that I would enter my own meditative state and see what happened. Well, the old man went into trance and began to study each of the people in this large circle. One by one, he would stare at each of the individuals who'd come to the seance. And when he stared at them, when he looked at them, they were full of fear. And they looked away. And every time when somebody looked away in fear, when they looked away in fright, this old man got stronger. He sat up straighter. His back went straight. His head came up. One by one, every person he looked at was cowed, was scared. The energy that this thing was beginning to generate was truly troubling almost everyone in the circle. Little by little, he was working his way around the circle, coming toward me. Well, I went into my meditative state. And in my meditative state, the technique that I use brings me to contemplate the sun. And I focus on the sun in the center of my being, focus on my own energy center. And then when I connect to that, I can project out energy. I can let that sunlight from inside shine brightly wherever I am. So I began to think that if that creature needed energy, I could offer it plenty of energy. And when I closed my eyes, I saw a very curious thing. I saw two Zen masters, one dressed all in white, one dressed all in black, like two ninjas. And they were squared off against each other, each one very wary, trying to judge the other one. Each one concerned that they were going to be overcome by the other. And then I sent my energy toward the creature, figuring I would let it have all the energy that it wanted. And I opened my eyes, and I was looking out at the creature, and it was looking right at me. And a funny thing happened. At that point, a woman's voice came from inside the little old man. And in this woman's voice, a voice said, "There's someone here who wants the truth. If he wants the truth, what is he doing here?" Well, I was quite surprised. And I remembered one of the things that I'd learned from reading the ancients. They said, if you're confronted by a spirit that's mischievous, that's misbehaving, what you want to do is, there is a sacred ancient oath that says, "I bind you to the throne of God. If you speak, you must speak the truth." Well, an interesting thing happened. When I said that aloud. Actually, I said that to myself. But at that point, this woman's voice coming from the old man said, "There's darkness. There's darkness everywhere." Well, they had requested that the lights be out. So technically, the creature was describing accurately what was going on. It was, in fact, night outside, and in fact, the room was quite dark because they'd insisted that the lights be put out. So I thought, if they're going to talk about darkness, which is only going to scare these people in the circle even more, I thought the thing to do next was to talk about divine darkness, about the good, the blessed side of darkness. So I said aloud, "Princess, if you're going to speak of darkness, then speak to us of Khafre." Well, Khafre, in Egyptian mythology, is the name of the sun at midnight, the beetle. Well, a most curious thing happened. When I said, "Princess, if you're going to speak to us of Khafre," in that same woman's voice, there was a scream, and she said, "The beetle!" And when she screamed and said, "The beetle," the old man fell out of his chair in the middle of the room, and he fell to the floor. And the woman, who was in charge of the little old man, his handler, came over to the little old man and tried to help him up. He was having a hard time getting up in the chair. And she said, "Oh my God, the princess has left him." Well, the person sitting next to me said, "What were you doing talking about Khafre? What's Khafre?" And I said, "Well, I could not stand by and let this spirit continue to torment these people. I didn't want it to continue to scare them because it was taking energy from the frightened people. And I, as a responsible person of some spiritual learning, could not stand by and let that happen. So I reminded that spirit of Kephra, which is the sun at midnight. In other words, even though the sun is out, the sun is dark, he's still the sun. And when I said that, the spirit left because it didn't want to be in a sacred place. Well, unfortunately, the person that invited me was very upset with me. He said, "My God, you drove the spirit away. We can't even play with him anymore because you made him go home." And I said, "Well, you wanted me to come and see. Was it a real spirit? You wanted me to come and see if this was the real thing." And, well, it was. It was the real thing. And it was really here. But I had to do my duty. I had to return us to a sacred space. And that's the story of Princess Tara. Are you there, Lillian? Are you there?
Yes, I am here. I was muted.
Oh, okay.
That was just an amazing story. I have to say you were cut out just a little bit there while you were when you first said what technique you were using. So you have to share that with us either now or today. I was desperate to hear it, and all of a sudden we got blank airspace.
Well, maybe that's one of the mysteries we need to keep quiet about now.
It's funny that the spirit, the evil spirit, was Tara, and Tara was a fountain of grace in my story.
Yes. Interesting ironies, huh?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, listen, Margaret has just joined us, and I guess we may have lost Kat due to technical difficulties.
Uh-huh.
But what I was thinking of doing is I was going to bring Margaret on, let her tell her story.
Mm-hmm.
And then you said you might be able to tell us one more little bit of yours.
I sure could.
Well, that's wonderful. Let me bring Margaret on.
Okay.
She says she's got a nice short little story. So without any further ado, I'd like to welcome Margaret. Margaret, welcome. Margaret, is that you?
Are you talking to me?
I'm talking to you indeed. Is this the fair lady, Margaret?
Kat.
Oh, this is Kat. Well, hi,
yes,
Kat.
I didn't know Margaret was calling in. I just was calling in to comment on your story since we cut off.
Sure, go ahead, dear.
Wonderful. And to me, I have to say this. I have to put it back to all the political stuff that people are doing. It's we have to create sacred space. When we see the impishness, we need to banish it with truth, you know, by standing in our truth. It was a wonderful story. And it's a wonderful story for All Hallows, too. Because the things that need to die, okay? And we do need to banish them with the truth. And so I saw wonderful correlations and very beautifully told.
Well, thank you, my dear. You know, I remember, and I bet you do, too, when some of the evil spirits were banished during the spiritual work that was the 60s.
Yes, and we're back to that. And, you know, and we're watching it unfold around the world this time. It's going to be worldwide, and we have to create the sacred space, especially we older people. We have to know that when there's impishness around, it's time to create the sacred space.
Well, Margaret,
that's what I was trying to get at in the story about having the three women creating the sacred space for it to happen. Is Margaret on?
Yes, she just arrived.
Okay.
Let me bring her on and let her tell her story.
I will listen and be quiet.
Oh, thank you, my dear. Margaret, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here again.
Hi, Margaret.
Nice to hear your voice.
Margaret, this is Kat. She's back from across the sea visiting the Seine.
Well, welcome, welcome, Margaret, to the Bard's Grove. I love all the bards that are gathering.
Thank you. I know. I can't wait to hear about your trip later.
Well, okay. Well, please tell us the story.
Well, I had discovered that we were going to celebrate Halloween with ghost stories, so I was at the library and found one that's a South Carolina ghost story.
Super.
It's called White Dog, and it's retold by S.E. Schlosser. A traveling salesman came to Goshen Hill for a few days, selling his wares from door to door. He was a friendly man with a warm grin and a joke for everyone. He was accompanied by a large white dog that rode on the wagon beside him, companion, friend, and guardian of his wares. The salesman and dog were making their way out of town when a murder was discovered in one of the places in which they had sported their wares. Suspicion blossomed at once against the stranger. Certainly no one the townsfolk knew was capable of committing such a crime, and a lynch mob chased the salesman out of town and strung him up on a tree beside the road. The white dog howled and barked and roared as the mob carried his master away. More than one man was bitten as the salesman, still screaming out his innocence, was silenced forever. One fellow finally shot his gun at the white dog, wounding it enough to send it whimpering away. It soon became obvious to everyone in town that they'd hanged the wrong man. The corpse, dangling obscenely from the tree on Old Buncombe Road, was a grisly reminder of the community crime. They'd have cut down the salesman and given him a decent burial, but the white dog stood guard over his master's corpse day after day, savagely threatening anyone who came near the hanging tree. So the salesman's body withered and rotted underneath the tree beside the road, filling the air with a terrible stench as it desiccated in the summer heat. It was many weeks before body and dog disappeared from the Old Buncombe Road. A few months later, a man who participated in the salesman's lynching happened to be walking down Old Buncombe Road at night. As he drew near the hanging tree, his nose wrinkled in disgust as a whiff of rotten flesh swept past his face and his stomach roiled. He staggered backward, his arm over his nose, wondering what was causing the terrible stench. Then he spotted the hanging tree and saw upon it a glowing, desiccated corpse dangling obscenely by the neck from one of its branches. And beneath the ghostly figure stood a huge white dog with glowing red eyes. The dog growled menacingly when he saw the man on the road, and the man stumbled backward over the rut in the center of the road and then started to run. With an ear-shattering series of barks, the white dog pursued the fleeing man with a supernatural speed. The man whipped this way and that, spinning around, leaping into the woods to dodge around trees, trying to avoid the huge dog snapping at his heels. If he fell, the dog would be at his throat immediately. The man crashed headlong into a tree and flung himself upward. Below him, the ghost dog leapt and sharp teeth closed on the man's hand. Pain ripped through him and he climbed higher, trying to shake off the glowing beast. "Let go," he screamed, kicking at it again. Suddenly, the white dog turned to mist before his eyes and swirled away. Realizing that the white dog might reappear at any moment, the man seized his chance. He slithered down the tree and ran all the way home. His wife sent a neighbor to fetch the doctor, who stitched up his hand as best he could. The white dog had nearly severed the palm, and the nerves were so badly damaged that he was crippled in that hand for the rest of his life. The man later learned that every person who had participated in the lynching of the salesman was attacked by the ghost of the white dog. Many, like himself, were crippled in some way. As for the fellow who'd shot and injured the white dog, well, his 4-year-old son disappeared and was never seen again.
Very good.
Yeah.
Wow.
American
quite a Halloween story.
Quite a Halloween story of the energies we leave behind.
Right. Why do you think they're guaranteed to give you nightmares?
Well, you know, as a Jungian psychologist, I would say that our unconscious uses them to symbolize our fears.
Wow, that's
so
great.
We work through our fears.
That's right. Rick told me that you were a Jungian. I have a group in Jupiter, Florida that I get together with once a month, and they're all Jungians, and a lot of them are therapists, and they're wonderful people. And we've been following a lot of Marion Woodman's work, and she was in Fort Lauderdale recently for the opening of the Jungian facility there.
Great. Yes, she's marvelous. She's marvelous.
Have you seen her film?
So we'll talk later about that. So your story was excellent. Thank you.
My pleasure. Well, we'll talk later.
Yeah.
Rick. Yes, my dear.
Did you have another story, or did Lillian?
I was going to let Lillian has another a real short one, a 3 or 4 minute. I was going to say, go ahead, Lillian, take it away.
Okay, I'll do that. All right. One of the good men that Finn had was Gaina, the son of Luga. His mother was the warrior daughter of Finn, and his father was a near kinsman of hers. He was nurtured by a woman that bore the name of Fair Maine, who had brought up many of the Fianna to manhood. When his time to take arms had come, he stood before Finn and made his covenant of fealty, and Finn gave him the captaincy of a band. But MacLuga proved slothful and selfish, forever vaunting himself in his weapon skills, and ever training his men to the chase of deer or boar, and he used to beat his hounds and his serving men. At last the Fians under him came, and their whole company to Finn at Loch Nina, at Killarney, and there they laid their complaint against MacLuga and said, "Choose now, O Finn, whether you will have us or the son of Luga by himself." Then Finn sent to MacLuga and questioned him, but MacLuga could say nothing to the point as to why the Fianna would none of him. Then Finn taught him the things befitting a youth of noble birth and a captain of men, and they were these. Son of Luga, if armed service be thy design, in a great man's house be quiet, be surly in the narrow path. Without a fault of his feet, without a fault of his, beat not thou hound, until thou ascertain her guilt. Bring not a charge against thy wife. In that battle, meddle not with a buffoon, for, O MacLuga, he is but a fool. Censure not any as he be of grave repute. Stand not up to take part in a brawl. Have not to do with a madman or a wicked one. 2/3 of thy gentleness be shown to women and to those that creep on the floor, and to poets, and be non-violent to the common people. Utter not swaggering speech, nor say thou wilt not yield what is right. It is a shameful thing to speak too stiffly, unless that it be feasible to carry out thy words. So long as thou shalt live, thy lord forsake not, neither for gold, nor for other reward in the world abandon one whom thou art pledged to protect. To a chief, do not abuse his people, for that is no work for the man of a gentle blood. Be no talebearer, nor utterer of falsehoods. Be not talkative, nor rashly censorious. Stir up not strife against thee, however good a man thou be. Be no frequenter of the drinking house, nor give to carping at the old. Meddle not with a man of mean estate. The sense thy meat freely, have no stinginessness for thy familiar. Force not thyself upon a chief, nor give him cause to speak ill of thee. Stick to thy gear, hold fast to thy arms till the stern fight with its weapon glitter be ended. Be more apt to give than to deny, and follow after gentleness, O son Luga. And the son of Luga, it is written, heeded these counsels and gave up his bad ways, and he became one of the best of Finn's men.
Very nice. Thank you.
Yep. You're welcome.
Thank you. That was great. So, looks like we have a few more minutes. You know, what about Halloween? How is Halloween affected, you know, going to be celebrated by all of us this year?
Well, I know I'm a big fan of high spirits. since I don't practice fear of death, I try to use Halloween and its celebration of spirits as a day of honoring the noble dead, of the great ones who've come before us, who built worlds and civilizations, who made learning and cut the path through the jungle for us. So I appreciate the Mexican view that it's a day of the dead, that we should celebrate them with reverence, with respect, and with celebration.
Yes, very nice. And now I know the picture I'm going to give you from my trip. You just gave me a clue. How are you going to celebrate, Lillian?
Well, I usually like to celebrate it alone. And I'll do some partying with some friends, just to be as merry and met with people who are near and dear to me. But on that eve, I will sit with a candle and commune with my departed mother. That's the night where I always take an opportunity to report to her how I've been doing in the world and to ask her guidance and her blessing on me for the year to come.
And how about you, dear Kat?
Wow, I have to comment. Wow, Lillian, that's a wonderful thing to do.
Thank you.
Yeah. Before me, what about Margaret? Why don't we let Margaret go first?
She has stepped away.
Oh, she has. Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to... There's a housewarming that we're having on Saturday night in an ancestor's altar. It's a group of priestesses and pagan friends that I do ritual with. Sunday we're going to do a big ritual for Sekhmet and Samhain. And Monday there is a parade here that my friends are going to be twirling fire at. So I'll probably do that. And then probably on Tuesday and Wednesday I'm going to borrow a leaf Lillian's book and, you know, spend a little time talking to my dad.
Cool.
Oh, yeah. Great.
So, well, thank you.
Kat, it's so wonderful to have you back. Any insights from across the water from our friends in Gay Paris?
Well, one of the things I noticed was that people are out and they use their TVs out more. And somebody might who's kind of introverted and tending to stay in, just gave me the feeling that maybe we need to go out again and meet our neighbors and go out and use our world in a different way.
I think that's a good idea. We must have a much closer sense of community.
Yeah.
And responsibility for each other.
Yeah. So,
well, we're down to our last minute, ladies. And
okay.
I have to say thank you to one and all who joined us. Merry meet.
And merry part. And merry meet again.
Again. And that's it for tonight's show from the Bard's Grove. Want to thank you one and all for joining us. And I hope you'll join us next week when we have more stories from the Bard's Grove.
Good night, Lantern.
Good night, dear. Good night, Lil.
Good night, Lily. Good night, Lantern. Good night, Kat.
Good night.
Good night.
get some music going here, and we'll do our outro. There we go. It's a show.
Okay.